This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, the Supreme Court fans the flames of discrimination in New Haven firefighter ruling.
But now, adding insult to injury, workers fight Wells Fargo to keep jobs and suffer arrest. UE Local 1174 members and supporters from other unions demonstrated at Wells Fargo's Rock Island, Illinois branch, echoing the slogan of UE members at Republic Windows during their plant occupation. They chanted, "You get bailed out, we got sold out." Nearly a dozen workers were arrested after they blocked a street to symbolize how Wells Fargo is a roadblock to recovery.
Workers are continuing their fight to keep Quad City Diecasting open to save their jobs. The plant is slated to close because Wells Fargo, recipient of $25 billion in federal banking bailout, has cut off operating credit for the company. Now, Keith Schribner, President Local 1174, United Electric Workers, UE, and Leah Freed, UE organizer.
You had a little clip you wanted to play.
Yeah, Ken. I had a clip of the demonstration last week. Let's play that.
Growing protests over the fate of local jobs. Top Show News.
It's the fourth protest against Wells Fargo by union members from QC Diecasting. They're upset the bank won't extend the company's credit to keep the company open and save their jobs.
What most businesses need right now when the economy isn't so good is some credit to get through.
Union members say several parties are looking to bid on QC Diecasting, but a purchase may not happen in time to save their jobs. That's why they're out here again, this time demonstrating that Wells Fargo is acting as a roadblock to recovery. So a group of them went into this busy Rock Island intersection to show that.
Wells Fargo, shame on you!
The small group was arrested, including Joe Osbaker's wife. The couple's from Chicago, and both lost their teaching jobs. They're part of several other unions participating here.
There's millions of people losing their jobs and losing their homes. It calls for more drastic action.
Getting arrested was a small concern when they think about losing what's become their careers.
Why'd you do this? Because I want to save my job.
In Rock Island, Kimberly Brown, 18 News.
Well, I'm getting pretty angry. $25 billion in federal banking bailouts, but the workers get a loss of jobs and arrested. Hey, what's happening?
You know, when Wells Fargo decided to no longer provide financing to Quad City Diecasting, and the workers find out that as a result, the company would be closing and over 100 people would lose their jobs, I think the decision was pretty clear that they wanted to fight, and they didn't think it was acceptable, and they're pretty disgusted, too. You know, in this market, it's really hard to find a job, and frankly, they didn't have much of an option. Either they fight to save their job or they face a pretty desperate situation.
Keith, tell us about Quad City Diecasting. What do they make? What's your job, and what are the workers doing?
It's been there for 60 years. It's a aluminum diecasting company. It's like a subcontracting company. It makes parts for Kawasaki, John Deere, and Case. Close to 100 people. And I've been there for about, it's going on 19 years this November. And like I said, it's been open for like 60 years.
And Leah, this is like the third case in which it isn't the primary villain, the people that you're fighting, maybe I'm wrong in this case, isn't the employer, but it's the banks that we're going after. I mean, there was the Hart Marks situation about 2 weeks ago, and there was, of course, the situation that UE had before that. Tell us what the strategy is and how that's working.
This is an interesting situation at Quad City Diecasting because it's a combination of both the situation that was at Hart Marks, where you have a company that announced it's going to close and the bank decides to liquidate and pay themselves instead of looking for someone to purchase it and keep it open and keep people employed. And it's similar to Republic Windows and Doors in that the employer was told by the bank, in this case, Wells Fargo told Quad City Diecasting they could not pay people their benefits. So they refused to pay vacations, and then on top of that, people aren't getting holiday pay. Their insurance has been canceled, and they've been denied a raise that was supposed to come in June in the contract. We need to start taking these banks to task. They took our money. They took our help when they needed it, and now they're essentially preventing economic recovery by throwing people out of work. They can't just say, well, this is our business decision anymore. We need to hold them to more scrutiny, and we need to demand more from them. So here at Quad City Die Casting, workers have been fighting, they've been protesting. They decided to block a road to get arrested because they wanted to show the world that Wells Fargo was a roadblock to economic recovery. I think they're prepared to do whatever they have to do. Right now, the plant is slated to close the end of August, and we've got quite a few elected officials in Illinois who are actively reaching out to the bank to try and get them in dialogue so we can actually get some resolution. But till then, they're going to keep fighting, right, Keith?
Exactly. We're going to fight till the end.
Keith, you had told me this afternoon when I talked to you that the controller of the state government was in yesterday or today?
Today. He was here at 9 o'clock this morning to talk to the people, and then he wanted to take a tour of the plant.
Keith, on top of that, I remember in the Republic Windows and Doors, President Obama even weighed in on that struggle. So aside from the controller, does the community have an understanding of what's being fought for here, how unfair, how wrong it is that bailout money is being spent and yet on the ground workers are drowning?
Exactly. We're not getting the help that we're supposed to be getting. The banks are denying us the financing. Yes, we've got, every time we go and protest in front of a Wells Fargo bank, we get so many supporters. Either they're standing there with us, or they're driving by honking their horns in support of for us.
Lair, is there any chance that the state government or some other entity might withdraw money from Wells Fargo like it was threatened with the Bank of America back in the other struggles?
Well, it's interesting because the elected official you mentioned just a minute ago, his name is Alexei Janulius. He is actually the Illinois state treasurer. He actually played that exact card during the Hartmarks fight and also during Republic Windows and Doors. He said, you know what, if you're going to act this way to our community, the state of Illinois is not going to do business with you. And that's an $8 billion threat. So I think that if it gets to that point, we may be looking at that kind of action on behalf of the government. And I hope they would take that step. But I think what we want to do right now is try and get Wells Fargo into a dialogue so we can at least extend the amount of time so that people can put together. There's several interested parties who are looking to buy the place. It's a company that, it's amazing. Keith has worked there for 19 years. People have been there for a very long time. They make a really high-quality product that's in demand. The reason that initially they were told the place would close last week and they had to announce that it would stay open another 6 weeks or so because there's such demand for the product. This is a company that should stay open. It's a business that should be invested in. And Wells Fargo, for whatever nefarious reasons, has made this terrible decision and has made it'll horribly impact the community.
I've got something to add to that. Our main customer is Kawasaki, and we have an excellent relationship with them because our parts are so good for them in that, and they're worried. They want to find somehow, some way to keep us open, and they want us to stay open. But the bank won't have any dialogue with us. We can't get the president of the company to dialogue with us. We need somebody to step in and make these guys sit down and talk to us. Somebody.
Well, and that's probably going to be the workers.
That's going to be the workers and their supporters all over the country. We demand that this plant stay open and that the workers continue to do the good work they do. Thank you so much, Keith Shribner, President, Local 1174, United Electrical Workers, and Leah Fried, Organizer Extraordinaire. Also with the UE. Now, I think one of the critical legal decisions that came down from the Supreme Court this term, when their written test for promotion in the fire department produced no successful African-American candidates, the city of New Haven nullified the results. White firefighters then brought a legal challenge against the city. the challenge was defeated by an appellate court that included Judge Sotomayor, now a nominee for appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court.
The New Haven case ultimately went to the U.S. Supreme Court, who overturned the appellate court. Justice Ginsburg, in a particularly pointed dissent to the majority ruling, gave historic background to the New Haven determination, reminding us that firefighting is a profession in which the legacy of racial discrimination casts an especially long shadow.
We're joined by Renika Moore, Associate Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and also Donald Day, past NE Regional Director Associate of the Professional Black Firefighters. And the Supreme Court fans the flames of discrimination in New Haven firefighting ruling. Donald, tell us a little bit about yourself and your experience with the issue of firefighting relevant to New Haven and what the circumstances and conditions of African-American firefighters were within the department.
I am a retired captain of Bridgeport, Connecticut Fire Department, which is about 12 miles outside of New Haven. At the time when this case first initiated, I was the director of the Northeast Region, so I had an opportunity to be involved with this case at its inception. Fire Department has a long and illustrious history of discrimination, an equally long and illustrious stance at giving tests that are disparate. City of Bridgeport, we had to sue the City of Bridgeport on two occasions because we received tests that had disparate impacts on African-American, Latino, and the last time was probably 20 years ago. Since that time, our city made a concerted effort to give a test that measured all the qualities that it took to be a good officer, a good lieutenant, a good captain or battalion chief, and New Haven failed to do that. New Haven News gave more weight to the written exam, which was scored 60% of that exam, and most American fire departments have abandoned such tests or limited the multiple-choice format to 30% or less of an applicant score. When New Haven used their multiple-choice test to measure its firefighters' retention of information from national firefighting textbooks and guides, civil service tests like these do not identify people who are best suited for leadership positions. We feel that the most important skills of any fire department, lieutenant or captain, are steady command presence, sound judgment, and the ability to make life-or-death decisions under pressure. It's impossible for a written exam to measure those qualities. That's where New Haven made its first mistake, was under the union's guidance, was to change the relative weights to 60% of the written and 40% for the oral, which gave an unfair advantage to those white candidates in a city that is 50% African-American, Latino. Less than 18% of their leadership are African-Americans and Latinos.
Renika, perhaps you can educate us on the law here in terms of what the appellate ruling was and what the Supreme Court did.
After the test was administered, when the results came back and the city of New Haven saw that none of the African-American firefighters who had sat for the exam were going to be eligible for promotion, they were concerned and they essentially said, let's take a moment, figure out what happened with this test and make sure that this was the fairest test that we could administer. And what they put together was a civil service board to review the exam, and they brought in test examiners. But essentially what some of the test examiners who looked at the test that New Haven had administered, they saw that what Mr. Day pointed out in terms of the test didn't capture certain things like command presence and the kind of things that are just really important for a firefighter to be able to do in order to be in a supervisory position. And so looking at the test, there was this independent civil service board, and once they reviewed, they essentially said there are other tests out there that we should try this again, and that would open the doors to the African-American and Latino firefighters in a way that this test didn't. When they decided not to use that test, that's when plaintiffs in this case, 12 plaintiffs, one Latino, the rest white, decided to file charges against the city of New Haven, essentially asserting that the city of New Haven had discriminated against them. The district court essentially found that because the city of New Haven's decision to not use the test was their attempt to avoid a potential lawsuit under Title VII, which is the statute that protects against discrimination, and that lawsuit says an employer can't use a system that looks neutral or a process that looks neutral on its face, but in fact, once it's administered, it weeds out large portions of protected groups, and so in this case, African Americans and Latinos. And the court said that the city of New Haven was within the bounds of Title VII and that what they had done did not violate the rights of the plaintiffs under Title VII or under the Constitution, which also provides under the 14th Amendment for equal protection regardless of race. The plaintiffs then appealed to the Second Circuit. And when they appealed to the Second Circuit essentially adopted the reasoning of the district court. And the Second Circuit is the panel that Judge Sotomayor was on. And that court said that the district court had properly applied Title VII, and that what the city of New Haven had done was in keeping with the law and what Congress really thought and what they intended for employers to do when they were faced with a situation where a test or a hiring process weeded out large numbers of African Americans or other minorities in a way that wasn't tied to the job itself. And that's really the history of Title, and even Title VII's expansion was initially only covered private employers, and when it was expanded to public employers, it was specifically because of firefighters, because there was such entrenched discrimination that they were seeing in fire departments and that they weren't seeing the progress racially or in terms of gender in integration of fire departments.
Captain, I wonder if you think, is it the test itself? You said that it's not measuring certain characteristics that are really significantly important for somebody to be in a supervisory position. But do you feel the tests are neutral? Are they slanted? How do we understand the problem with the testing procedure?
The testing procedure, if you use tests, focuses on job challenges and focus on problem solving in the relative context, African Americans and Latinos do as well, if not better than our white counterparts on those kind of exams. It's just the memorization part of the test, which really don't have any relevance in firefighting, that they score better than African Americans. Like when I made captain, I came out number two, 300ths of a point from number one. To me, what's important to me is if I have a fire, occupied structure, 2 o'clock in the morning, exposures on the B and the D side, how would I handle this fire? Well, being 2 o'clock in the morning, it's occupied structure. I know somebody's probably in that house. It's probably occupied. Somebody might be trapped in there. You got the exposures on the left and right side of this fire. I want to make sure that fire don't spread. And I want to tell my additional companies where they should be. These are the kind of tests, real life experiences in the fire service that African Americans and Latinos do extremely well on. And like I said, as well as our white counterparts. And anytime you use the norm, the standard in firefighting is not to score the written exam, which is nothing but memorization, higher than 30%. Bridgeport, we use 60% for the oral or the assessment, 30% for the written, and 10% for seniority. And we don't have a problem getting a extremely diverse leadership in our department. And that's where New Haven dropped the ball. And let me just say one thing. This exam has never been validated. They've never done a validity study on this exam to find out if it was indeed valid. This was destined to fail right from the beginning when New Haven changed their testing company and hired IO Solutions. When they did that, we went to New Haven and told them that if you look at IO Solutions' website, they list 119 cities where they've administered tests for promotions. Out of these 119 cities, there wasn't one city in there that was the population of New Haven, nor was there one community in there that had the diverse population of New Haven. This was a testing company that has administered tests for very small departments. And we told them right from the beginning that they lacked the capacity to put together a test that, one, would not have a disparate impact, and an exam that would be fair to not only African Americans and Latinos, but whites as well, and would in turn give your department the best candidates to be lieutenants and captains.
So, Renika, when the Supreme Court overruled the decision, were they basically saying that the other court had made a mistake under existing law, or are they changing the interpretations of the law?
Right. They actually established a new standard that wasn't in place prior to June 29th when this decision was handed down. What the court essentially did is they imported a standard based on the constitutional standard that exists for the equal protection, which is a different law. It's a protection that wasn't conceived of in the conception of Title VII. And so the court basically said, it's not enough for the city to have a good faith belief that they might have been sued and that there was a disparate impact based on the statistics which showed what Justice O'Connor called the inexorable zero, in that there were no African Americans who would have been up for promotion. The court said that wasn't enough, and that the fact that there was testimony of other test experts saying that this test hadn't been content validated, the court said that that still wasn't enough, and they really showed an insensitivity to both the history and legacy of discrimination and to the facts that were present in this case in particular. So they did establish a new standard. I mean, what we see in the dissent is the dissent really saying that you're ignoring a lot of the circumstances and the context of what's going on in New Haven, what the community looks like, what happened with this test. And I think this is consistent with this court. We've seen them moving away from a history or from precedent that was doing what it could to open the doors for previously excluded groups.
I remember one of the many demonstrations I went to in Washington, D.C., and this one was really coordinated by the National Conference of Black Lawyers and various support groups, and that was when the first, quote-unquote, reverse discrimination lawsuit came into being, and that was the case of Alan Bakke. And the chant was kind of, we're going to beat, beat back, the Bakke attack. All right, I won't go any further with that. But ever since the Alan Bakke case, it would seem that the consent decrees that have been put in place, such as the New Haven one, have begun to systematically be dismantled by legal challenge, not unlike the one of the white firefighters in New Haven. So is affirmative action, which essentially, if I were to describe it, is a leveling to some degree of the playing field based on the history and the reality of racism in this country. Is it really shot at this point? Has it really gone up in flames? Can we still use affirmative action as some redress?
This case was unusual because, first, yes, I think there is still something to be salvaged. I think we've clearly lost ground, and this decision made it harder for employers to proactively work to open their doors and to make their workplaces more diverse and to allow previously excluded groups in. But at the same time, what the court did was essentially say that an employer really has to show, the term they used was strong basis in evidence, but that they have to show clearly why they believe that they would be subject to a lawsuit based on the disparate impact standard, based on the fact that there's a practice that appears to be neutral on its face that's excluding people. And so I think there is still a requirement that employers follow and that they really try to work to bring in more people. And if they see that there's a practice that's doing so, that's excluding people, that they work to make sure that and root that out. But what I think this decision really does is requires employers to take steps before they administer the test. So in this situation and in firefighting departments across the country, the idea is that you get the test right the first time. And so I think New Haven's position was made harder by the fact that they had this exam, that people knew the results, and so you had an identifiable group who felt like they were losing something, which LDF doesn't really necessarily think that the promotions were the entitlement of the plaintiffs at the point in which the test was thrown out. But I think they created a problem for themselves by administering the test and then trying to get rid of the test once the results were known. So what this decision does is make it so that employers really have to try harder at the front end to really make sure that they're using a process that's fair and equal.
Where did the New Haven firefighters go from here?
Well, the New Haven firefighters are waiting for the city to ultimately do what they're going to do, certify the list. And once the city certifies the list, it's my understanding that the New Haven firefighters are going to file a lawsuit to say the test was never validated, so we don't know if we have a valid exam or not, and move forward from that perspective. And let me just say that it was an awful decision what the Supreme Court did, but it's not as awful as it could have been. What the court did was totally screwed up voluntary compliance, which was one of the main goals of Title VII. Mm. We're concerned in that if a city don't have to voluntarily comply with Title VII, then it'll go back to where it was when I first came on the job. They'll give the cheapest test possible because, you know, the economic climate of today isn't good. So cities will go back to doing cheapest tests possible, and it'll have monumental consequences on blacks that aspire for upward mobility in the fire department.
Hmm. I'm just pausing for a moment because I think the consequences are so significant. I know that Council Renika Moore has put a good spin on it, and obviously we have to. We did that with so many of the prior cases that came down from the Supreme Court, unfortunately, when it came to affirmative action. But I guess at the same time, when we have people like Captain Day, we will continue to struggle. And whether it's getting it better or right the first time so it will be less subject to challenge, whether it's getting the educational system right the first time, so that becomes part of the process, or perhaps a better political sensitivity in our society as a whole as to its collective obligation to remedy the legacy and the apparent and real effects of racism within virtually, not virtually, I would say every endeavor within our society has the remnants of these inequities, these disparities, these very real aspects of historic discrimination. And you look like you want to give it a punctuation, Renika.
No, I just think that we are seeing a systematic attack across sectors. So whether it's education, we had a case for the court this season, the voting rights case, where we're seeing concerted effort to really draw back the civil rights protections that the Legal Defense Fund and lots of other organizations fought to get in place in the first place. So in this case, in Ritchie, we're fighting for the standard that we pushed for in Griggs v. Duke back in the 70s, yeah, where we're trying to get rid of these headwinds to the advancement and the advancement or even just the entrance of minorities into these community, into these occupations. And so we're also seeing that in voting rights with the Northwest Utility District, where we saw the Center for Individual Rights, which is an organization that is mounting a concerted effort to peel back the civil rights protections. And so these certainly aren't anomalies. They're definitely looking for these cases. And I think that's an important thing to think about as employers try to comply with these requirements, that there is an actual concerted effort to really do something about these civil rights protections and to really undermine them. And they've got a friendly court.
And I can't think about any better legal organization to continue the good fight other than the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund and one of its newer attorneys, Renika Moore, who is associate counsel. And you're in the economic justice component of it. And Captain Donald Day, past Northeast Regional Director of the Association of Professional Black Firefighters, thanks to both of you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, and thank you for having us. This is a very important dialogue, and I appreciate your station for doing this.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.